Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 359. And we're here tonight live on Rumble, Odyssey, DLive, and Entropy. So please do share the links. We've got Steve Laws here with us tonight. I'm going to be introducing him soon, and we're going to talk about a lot of top stuff, even touching on some of the demos we've been doing, because unfortunately Steve couldn't make the stream after the last demo in Nuneaton, so we'll talk about that briefly as well. And we'll also be talking about UK and world politics. So if that's the kind of thing you like, it'll be a two-hour stream. The first hour will be us chatting. The second hour will be us answering your questions. Now, that's not all I've got planned for this week. I've got another packed week of content. Tomorrow, I'll be live with David Duke at 4 p.m. on the Rents Radio Network. Friday night, I'll be doing a live stream, probably focusing on the situation in Iran and the political fallout. On Sunday, it'll be the return of the Nationalist A-Team. I know it's always here, but we missed Sunday night this time because it was Easter Sunday. But it'll be the first A-Team stream with Sam Melia back. Big Sam will be back on the team. So it's going to be a good night. So that'll be one to look forward to because it's great having Sam back. And last time we had Sam back, it was to talk about his time in jail, which was absolutely fantastic. It was a really, really good stream. Really wonderful to have him on, but to have him back just chatting and having a laugh with us will be pretty special too, because I've really missed that and I've really missed doing regular streams with him. So loads of things coming up later this week, both on my channel and elsewhere. Also, talking of Sam Melia, the last Sunday of this month we'll be doing a review of Sam's book. So if you haven't got a copy of that, pick it up. That's called Legal, Truthful, Guilty. It's about his trial and his time in jail. So there's a few things we've got coming up this week and later in the month. Now, if you support my work, if you like what I do, please do consider giving a small donation throughout the stream. You can donate through Entropy. Now, there's been some issues with Entropy, and my Entropy donations have fallen off because there's been some uncertainty about the platform and people writing to me saying I was going to give a decent amount, substantial amount, but I didn't want to because apparently there's issues with it. Well, people haven't been paid because Entropy have been interfered with, but I've spoken to the developers and they've assured me everyone is going to be paid. And, you know, they're just working through a few kinks, but the money is still all there. Everything's fine. So if you want to give through Entropy and you want to give generously, I'm keeping my trust in them. I know some content creators like Devon, Stack and Red Ice have said, like, don't give through Entropy. But if you want to give to me through Entropy, please do. I've supported them since they started up. They've supported me. I don't like to drop people that have been so good to me. And I'm certainly not giving up on them. So if you want to continue donating through that platform, I've got faith in them. I'm pretty sure they'll stick to their word. When I say pretty sure, you can't be 100% sure. But if I was to give a figure, I'd say I would be 99.9% sure they'll be good to their word. They always have been. And they are a nationalist Christian couple with children. They're good people, both the husband and the wife. Very, very approachable. So I want to keep supporting their project. And I hope you will keep supporting me through that. You can also donate through Rumble. You can do that at any time you want. And any note or question attached to a donation we'll read out in the second half of the stream. Now remember, if you don't donate, I can't keep doing this. Unfortunately, I survive off people's generosity. So if you can give something, $3, $5, $10, whatever you can afford, if you can give more, it really is appreciated. If you do want to give a substantial amount, it is really appreciated, because obviously with the Entropy issues, this month has been a pretty rough month, but I'm assuring you, you can keep using Entropy. So if you want to help, please do. You can also donate via crypto. All the crypto links are in the description below. And finally, you can write to me at any time at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. I'm always here to help people out, support people, and to make sure that you have community behind you if you're going through bad times. So remember, I do all of that free of charge and never charge people who come to me. What you see me getting here tonight on stream, that is my income. So please support that. All the other stuff I do, the patriotic alternative stuff, the work behind the scenes, helping young men, helping people in need, That's all on top of that, and I don't charge for that or take a wage. So if you can give generously, please do. And nothing I've ever done has gone behind a paywall. Anyway, sorry for the slightly lengthy introduction, but I do want to talk about things coming up in the month and set people's minds at ease with Entropy. And also remember, if you're watching on replay, you can donate anytime through Entropy on replay. So if you're one of the thousands of people that watch on replay, please do consider giving a donation. All the Entropy links are in the description of the video. Anyway, we've got an amazing guest tonight. It's, of course, Steve Laws. Steve Laws is one of the most notable campaigners against demographic change and for remigration. In fact, he is the man in Britain that is most associated with the term remigration, and he runs a wonderful group called Remigration Now. He's very active on Twitter. The police have got their boot on the back of his neck at the moment, investigating him for tweets. He is one of the people, though, that doesn't let that get him down. He is still active on the streets. He's active online. And he is a tireless campaigner for our cause. Steve, I was going to ask, how have you been? But I saw you the other weekend. How have you been since the other weekend? And how do you feel the last weekend of activity in the Neaton went?
Yeah, I've been good, thank you. Thanks for having me back on. As for the demo, yeah, I thought it was quite good, to be honest. We had more than what arrived in Warwick, and everyone that was there was on high spirits. Everyone was an ethno-nationalist. I thought it was a good demo, to be honest. There was no trouble or anything like that. There wasn't even any opposition other than like one or two weirdos. So I thought, yeah, it was quite a good event, to be honest.
I liked it. And I think it's gathering momentum. It does make a big difference, though, when there were no lefties there. So it kind of adds a dampener, doesn't it? If there's hundreds of lefties screaming at you. But it was kind of almost like a carnival atmosphere because people were just popping by, having a chat. We were doing the media interviews. And there wasn't that kind of negative feeling or negative energy you get when two sides are sort of going at each other. And one thing that I've never liked about demos is often demos become less about the public and the demo themselves and more about that kind of fracas with the left. But I felt without that, it did feel more relaxed, and it really, really did feel as if we had something special going. And one thing I noted as well, despite people meeting at the pub beforehand and going to the pub afterwards, people behaved really respectfully. There wasn't that kind of drunken element you get at a kind of more Tommy Robinson style or Sivnet event. People were pretty disciplined too, weren't they?
Yeah, that's the thing. I met a lot of the people that that's the Wetherspoons before the protest, but we all only had one pint, and it was just more of a social thing rather than getting a drunk. It was more just a landmark. Everyone knew the location to meet there, and then we'd drag them down to the protest. But yeah, it was a very good atmosphere, I thought, to be honest. The fact that we had all of these groups standing together again, none of them were arguing or having disagreements and saying, I don't stand with that group, or I don't want to stand with that group. Everyone was getting on with the job, even if there were people that didn't necessarily like one another. And I thought that was quite a positive sign moving forward. So there's definitely potential for these protests to grow in time. I think more people that see them without any kickoffs going on or any trouble will eventually want to come out and join us and stand with us. So it's a long process to get it to be in thousands and thousands of people, but you have to start somewhere.
Well, I agree. And I think Warwick set the template. People standing together, nationalist unity, everyone working together. And look, I'm going to put this out there because I'm not ashamed of it. We worked really, really hard with the police on both Warwick and Nuneaton to ensure that we had good places to stand, to ensure that the events were policed correctly, to ensure that we had the right sort of tone of material there so people weren't going to be arrested. And I think that's really important because you can do this thing where you say, right, we're just going to turn up and to hell with it. But the police can then get, I think it's a section, I can't remember the actual number, section something will say dispersal order and decide that they're sending you all home. But by working with the police liaison units, we have brought a degree of professionalism to these events, and they have got more professional. So this time we had proper speaker systems there. So in the past, we didn't used to have those. We had a megaphone. This time we had proper speaker systems. We had music before the event. And I think it all came across a lot more professional, and we have grown. And the impressive thing is, you know, without harking back to what I said about money earlier, you know, me and Steve don't make huge amounts of money. You know, for example, for the first 8 days of this month, I've made about sort of $300 on one stream with Blair Cottrell. It's not like a huge amount of money. We do all of this on a real shoestring budget. This isn't sort of the Tommy Robinson roadshow where people are getting paid 10, 20 grand a week. This isn't a situation where we raise $500,000 for an event and fly people in from all over the world. Everything's done on this real shoestring budget. So when you see things getting more and more professional, it's due to hard work. It's due to people chipping in. It's due to everyone maximizing what they can do on a very, very small budget. So there's a lot more to be proud about than if you just have somebody come in and say, look, here's £500,000, put on a big event in London. You know, we're not there. And we're not there because we don't have the big donors. We don't have like the Israeli support detachment that are there to pump the money in. But I think we're pulling things off that are more and more impressive on a very tight budget, which I think in itself makes it a lot more noteworthy.
Yeah, I agree. Like none of it's fake. It's all organic. It's all grassroots. It's just proper nationalists coming out, trying to make their voice heard, trying to make it as professional as possible on what little resources we have. That's why it's important that all of these small groups that we've got, like the activist groups and stuff, should work together and share resources, because there's no point us all like holding our own individual little tiny protest. We're better off standing together. We all pretty much stand for the same message anyway. So ultimately, putting all our resources and energy into one big event every few weeks, about every like 6 to 8 weeks, is a lot more beneficial, I think, in my eyes, than everyone just having one as and whenever they really can. So I think if we keep building on this, they're only going to get more professional. They're only going to get more of like the locals to turn out and stand with us. We've already seen people that would never normally come to these protests, come into these protests. So that's a positive sign. Normally, they would want to stay well clear. So we can definitely build on this, I think. I think it's got potential to grow.
I completely agree. And I think we have to prove things to people, because a good few years ago, Patriotic Alternative really hit their stride. We were really sort of motoring, and we were getting 400 or 500 people at these demos. We had great demos in Skegness, in Cannock. And the wind was taken out of our sails by people who sort of, by a couple of different people who sort of connived to undermine us, either by causing splits internally or by trying to arrange protests every single week. But now those sort of people have been exposed for who they really are. And me and Steve, we're working very closely together. We're working with other content creators like Hugh Anthony. We are helping young content creators who are putting things out on YouTube, who are vlogging this, who are doing the live streams. We're giving them all interviews. We're enticing people there, and we're showing people that we can build up momentum. And I'm hoping to get this by the summer to a really big demo somewhere, you know, at a flashpoint area that gets us sort of 500-600 people. And we sort of really break the mold with what we're doing. And to do this as genuine ethno-nationalists, it's a lot harder than doing it as the CivNats, because we're going out there with a message that, you know, people do push back on a lot harder, but it's a lot more important message. And if you watch the speeches, which are up on our Telegram or on Steve Law's X account, you can see that the speeches were genuine ethno-nationalist speeches. No one pulled their punches at that event. And I think it really showed. And I think the crowd was very, very appreciative of what we had to offer.
Yeah, that's one of the things as well that's very different to like, for instance, our protest to what you would see at like a Tommy Robinson event or a UKIP one, is the people that are actually speaking actually care for the people of this country. They're going to be honest with you. They're not going to tell you fairy tales. They're not going to say this person's this immigrant's fine and this immigrant's fine just to sort of please the optics crowd. There's not going to be any of that nonsense. Everyone's just going to come down. If they're speaking, they're going to say about demographics, they're going to talk about remigration, they're going to talk about the migrant hotels and so forth, and they're going to just say honestly what's happening and what they think should be done with it. And I think that's the best approach. There's no point trying to water down our message or anything like that. Everyone knows what we stand for now anyway. It's our job to make everyone else move towards that position. So we have to go out there, be openly ethno-nationalist, and just keep pushing forward, because otherwise the alternative is we have years and years more of these UKIP and Tommy Robinson protests that go nowhere, and they have the Africans on the stage singing Kumbaya, or the Maori doing the Haka and so forth, and it just becomes embarrassing. So we definitely have to just keep pushing forward.
I agree, and it's interesting we're talking about this, because we're sort of building this genuine nationalist street movement. This is the first topic I wanted to talk to you about this evening. Now, you've been a bit of a tourist when it comes to electioneering. I've only ever stood for one party, that was the BNP. You've stood for multiple parties. I think it's UKIP, English Democrats, Homeland. Did you stand for Reform as well?
No, I was going to stand for Reform, but they dropped me as a candidate.
So basically, you could have stood for four different parties at this point. And obviously, you've been somebody who's been, you know, involved in local electioneering. I have as well, but sort of longer back in time than you. You're far more recent with that. But we are on the, well, tomorrow at 4 p.m, nominations close for the next round of elections in England and Wales. I think there might be some in Scotland as well this year. But these local elections, what's your feeling towards them? Because nominations close tomorrow. And obviously, there's going to be this issue of all of these nationalist micro parties. I mean, you know, you've got the National Rebirth Party. We'll talk about their sort of little faux pas at the weekend if you want to. You've got sort of what's left of the Homeland Party, the British Democrats, the English Democrats, probably numerous other groups. The National Front, they usually stand one or two. I mean, from my perspective, I feel it's all got a little bit embarrassing. And I'll do a sort of a bigger breakdown, sort of both predictions and results nearer the time. But what's your feeling towards these local elections? How do you think they're going to work out? Do you think Reform are going to be the big winners again? What do you think the fate will be of these micro parties? And I know we're already in April. And April's meant to be the sort of big electioneering month. But I don't feel any buzz about these elections whatsoever. You know, despite the fact that, you know, when I was back in the BNP, the Easter weekend or the Easter break was sort of your big time for a big push. Everyone was off work. Everyone was leafleting. The bank holidays, there was teams out doing things. Everyone was buzzing for the elections. But I don't feel anything this year. Not just from the mainstream parties, but even from the nationalist micro parties. And despite the fact the country is probably in the worst state of turmoil it's been in since the winter of discontent in 1979, I don't really feel as if there's a buzz for genuine change at the ballot box.
No, well, this is the thing. All of these micro parties haven't really got any campaigns underway. The only one that I've seen actually out leafleting and campaigning are the British Democrats. So they may be fielding a few. Homeland's last local election fielded six. I was one of them, but we did absolutely awful. But we won't say no more about that. So essentially, I think if they don't field six, then that shows that there's major decline in the party. Yerbury's party, the National Rebirth Party, he said he's got like a 30-year plan before they even field candidates. So I don't
We'll be a minority by 2050, mate. But no, by the time he's ready to field a candidate, we're already a minority.
I know, I did try explaining this when I had the discussion, but that seems to be where he's set his sights on. English Democrats, I don't think, have got any candidates that I know of. UKIP is pretty much just Tenconi now. Even their own councillor candidate sort of left and made her own party. So that's another micro party that's formed. Advance, I don't know what they're doing for locals, but I can't imagine they're going to have much success going by their general election results. So my opinion is all of these micro parties should just fold. There's Restore Britain there offering you an alternative with a mainstream appeal, that if they want to get into electoral politics, that's the best route that we've got available. If you don't want to take the Rupert approach, there's still Reform that you can try and get into, I suppose. So there's both of those routes that I don't think there's any need for a micro party. You could argue that there was the need for them before, when there wasn't like a Restore Britain, because you need a nationalist vehicle pushing pushing the window, so to speak. But at the moment, there's no need for them whatsoever. So they should just either fold and become an activist group, or if they still want to do politics, then set up a branch within one of these major parties and move forward from there. Because anyone who fields one of the at these elections is going to get like 100, 200 votes, and then reform's going to clean up. I think Restore Britain are only sort of fielding around Great Yarmouth, so they may clean up there. But everywhere else is going to go to Reform and Labour, is how I'd imagine it.
Well, it's quite interesting you say that, because my analysis was Reform were like this big, unstoppable electoral force, which were going to smash all of the smaller parties and just sweep them to one side. And they did that pretty spectacularly with Advance UK in the Gorton and Denton by-election, where Advance UK ended up being beaten so hard into submission. They were humiliated after coming behind the monster raving loony party. I think, what was the guy called? Sir Oinkalot. They had a guy in a pig mask called Sir Oinkalot. And they actually beat, or Sir Oinkalot beat, the Advance UK candidate. Highly embarrassing. But the argument against my point was like, well, Reform aren't exactly who we'd vote for, so these micro parties serve a purpose, because if Reform collapses, you know, there's something then to the right to scoop up the votes, and there's something on the ballot paper that presents sort of a harder option. But that's dead now, isn't it? Because now Restore are there, what's the point? You know, so if you're a normie, you're going to vote Reform first, because it's an established name and it's got Farage at the helm and everyone knows them. If you're a bit more awake to what's going on and you understand that Rupert Lowe's entered the fray and he's an ethno-nationalist, you're going to vote for Rupert Lowe. What percentage does that leave the micro parties with? And I'm actually asking that to you, because last time, Homeland, I mean, it was a disaster, wasn't it? I think they were getting like 1.2, 1.6%, utterly awful votes. But that was without Restore. So where are they going now?
Well, this is the thing. I don't see there any need for them whatsoever. There's no real difference to a Homeland policy to a Restore Britain policy. You could just say they're more nationalist based, but that doesn't really mean anything when you've only got, say, 300 members. So I don't see the point in them. They're going to, obviously, I should imagine they will field candidates in the local election. I've got no information of what goes on in the party anymore. But seeing the output, I've not seen any campaign trails, although they did not put the campaigns on social media in the last local elections, because they wanted to give the candidates a bit of a free roam before, like, all the leftist media outlets sort of done their thing, which is fair enough. But I've heard nothing about them standing in any local elections. I've not heard of any candidates. So I think they're probably done, but they haven't just accepted it yet, because now there is Restore Britain, like you were saying. There is no real need for them whatsoever. Like, at the best, it's like a group to keep people in like nationalist sort of community base. But then there's no need for it to be a party. They may as well just fold and become sort of like a social club or something, because it's a waste of time now. There's Restore Britain, and any nationalist party that's trying this approach is wasting their time. The Yerbury thing's completely different. Some of the people in that party are just absolutely nuts. So I think there is a place. I think there is a place for Yerbury's party. It scoops up a lot of the weirdos, so it's nice to have that in the corner.
Yeah, what did you make of the Yerbury party man that decided to post the bold statement in picture format that he believes that Rupert Lowe should be executed and his family imprisoned? I mean, look, I'm not for Fed posting at all. So don't go out and Fed post. Do not threaten anyone with violence, period. No exceptions, no small print. Do not threaten anyone with violence. But we live in a frustrating world, and there are people out there that push you to the point of maybe thinking about Fed posting. So when you see an ex-Labour councillor who's been done for serious acts of paedophilia and they walk free from court, you're thinking to yourself, there needs to be a serious shakeup of the system here. And maybe that judge could do with a few months in jail himself. You know, maybe that's what you're thinking. But why would you like Fed post about Rupert Law? I don't understand what they hope to gain by that. Because from my point of view, out of everyone that has ever sat in Parliament, Rupert Lowe's the best of them all. So post-Second World War, of everyone that has walked into Parliament, by a long chalk, Rupert Lowe's the best. So why would you single him out? And why would you suggest something as terrible as imprisoning his family as well, so his family line's wiped out? I mean, who are these people trying to appeal to?
Yeah, this is what I mean. They're nuts. Like, that's not a sane position to hold. Like, their issue with Rupert Lowe is that he's a bit of a Thatcherite and he's like an old school economic Tory, and that's kind of their concern with him. But as you're saying, like, he is the best option in terms of all of the MPs in the Houses of Parliament. Like, there's no better MP in there than Rupert Lowe. He holds our position. But these NRP guys, like, they just go off the rails. Like, most of their graphics, like, at best, are like a bit like meh. That there's nothing spectacular. But that is just an insane thing to post, especially with like your party's logo and that. It's the sort of thing that'll end up getting you prescribed or something like that. And I said to Yerbury, I said, is it the NRP position to I posted to I tagged him on Twitter. I was like, is the NRP position to hang Rupert Lowe and his family and imprison his family? And he said, if he meets our standards of criminality. And I'm thinking, like, so I just replied, do you believe that he's guilty of those charges? And like, it's just they're nuts, mate. Like, there's no reasoning with them. They've gone down such an insane sort of rabbit hole that they think they're the only true nationalists in the country now, and everyone else is insane. But in reality, they're scaring more people away from nationalism than they are actually helping.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I didn't understand any of that. And I've got to say this. So looking, if you're a political party and you're registered as a political party, you exist for one reason and one reason alone. And that is to do better in the next election than you did at the last election. And the only way you can do that is by standing more candidates and getting better votes. That's a pretty obvious thing to say, but I feel I need to state that, because at this point, if you are part of one of those micro parties, and this round of elections, you're getting worse results, standing fewer candidates and being completely upstaged, I do wonder when people are going to come to their senses and just wrap these things up, because I can't honestly understand what the point of this is anymore. It's completely failed. Now, there's so many good things for people to put their money and time into, whether it's advocacy groups, whether it's campaign groups like Remigration Now, whether it's land buying groups like the Woodlander Association, you know, whether you want to stick 20 quid into the political prisoner fund that we run. I think there's so many good uses for nationalists' money, but the idea that a small party should be spending 4, 5, 6 grand on local elections to average 1.3%, I don't understand what anyone hopes to gain by this anymore.
There's nothing to gain from it. This is the issue, but it's most of these party leaders are keeping the parties alive because it financially benefits them. And it will damage their income and their livelihood if the party folds. And that's why a lot of these are still ticking over. And that's the harsh reality of it. It's not for the movement that they're keeping it alive or for the cause. It's strictly for self-interest. And that makes the things ever so much worse, because they're there for no reason other than themselves.
So I'm going to hit you with a big question now, because obviously one of the main topics I want to talk about is the Kanye West topic. I find this really, really interesting that they've banned Kanye West. I think he must be. Is he the first black guy that's ever been banned from coming to Britain?
Probably. I've never really thought of it like that. But yeah, probably is, to be honest. They normally just ban white Europeans, don't they?
Well, this is the thing. And I know that you're. It's fair to say you're not a Nigel Farage fan, are you?
No, not really. No.
No, I mean, I'm not a Farage fan, but I want to qualify that, because although I'm not a Farage fan, I am actually respectful of the things that he's achieved. So people often say to me when I do these streams, you talk quite highly of him, Mark. And I do talk highly of him. And I'll explain why without being sycophantic. Is despite the fact he is not my cup of tea, and despite the fact he is very anti-ethno-nationalism, at least outwardly so anyway, he is somebody who exists outside of the two main parties, and he has managed to win three national elections, probably become one of the three most recognisable post-war political figures, up there with Blair and Thatcher. And he seems to have done more than anybody else outside of people within the two-party oligarchy. And I've got to respect him for that, despite the fact he ain't me and I'm not him and we wouldn't agree. And he probably hates me. He probably, you know, if you ask him, what do you think of Mark Collett? I should imagine he'd say Mark Collett is a complete scumbag, you know, wouldn't have anything to do with him. And often Farage does and says things that really annoy me. And people have seen me tear into him. I've made several videos talking about terrible things he said and done. But it did shock me that he came out and said, why are we stopping people coming to this country who've never broken the law, have the wrong opinion, and are basically going to come here, perform at a concert, you know, bring tens of millions of pounds worth of, create tens of millions of pounds worth of business, but we'll let anyone in a small boat who's been on a raping spree somewhere else in the world come here and defend to the hilt their right to be here, despite the fact they've done horrific things to women overseas and may well do the same or are likely to do the same to women here. But a guy with the wrong opinions, that's where we draw the line. Now, Farage is a bit of a cook a lot of the time, but I was impressed by this. And, you know, I think we should, my way of seeing these politicians is we should treat them like dogs. If a dog does something you like, what do? You give him a doggy treat and you pat him on the head, you know, give his, you know, fur a stroke. But if a dog does something you don't like, what do? Well, you know, out comes the slipper. And I think with politicians, you've got to treat them the same way. You know, give them a good dressing down and hold their feet to the fire when they disappoint you. But I think it's only fair when they do something or say something you like to say, well, actually, this guy said something decent this time. I mean, what are your thoughts on Farage on this one? Because, you know, he's not always right, but this time.
Yeah, it's a weird one. Like, I'm not going to die on the hill of letting an African into Britain. That's not like my major concern. But if you look at it from a pure fact that he's coming over to do a job and then he's going, and he's going to bring a lot of revenue to the country, Farage is right in terms of defending that situation. And obviously, we all know why he's bad. He's upset the Jews. And obviously, it shows you how much influence they've got in the country that they can literally get you banned from the country you're going to perform at. That's the real core issue of the problem. But to see Farage come out and openly defend someone who's been so hostile towards the Jews as well is a weird situation, considering Farage is like a raving Zionist and usually bends over backwards for them. So it was strange to see him actually come out and defend them. Personally, I'm not really a Kanye West fan, so it doesn't really bother me either way. It's just another African not in the country. But for those who are fans, I can see why they're pissed off at the situation. Like you say, anyone can flood into the country, but now because someone said something that the Jewish lobbies don't like, now all of a sudden he's not allowed in the country. So I can understand the situation, but to see Farage actually come out and defend it was a bit of a shock, to be honest.
You raise an amazing point there, though, Steve. It's like black man who really poses no genuine threat to anyone other than upsetting Jews is banned from coming to the country. But, you know, untold numbers of undocumented migrants can flood in. And not only do they get in here, but when they do commit these heinous acts like rape, we're always told by some liberal judge that we can't send them back because it would deny them a fundamental human right. The latest thing is, if you're an African guy who comes here and you have a kid here, basically you can do whatever you want and you will not be deported, because they will play this card of, it's called right to a family life. Under this human rights legislation, everyone has the right to a family life. So if you've come here, you've had a child, the child was obviously born on British soil, so of course he or she's allowed to stay. You cannot be denied the right to see your child, so you can't be deported. And I find all of this irritating, to say the very least. I mean, really, it's enraging. I wasn't going to go to the festival, I'll put it like that. I wasn't going to go to the festival, but it would have been entertaining to see the meltdowns if he'd have been allowed in. But now the whole festival's been cancelled, and it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because this harks back to last summer, because there was that guy, the black guy called Bob Villain, who was hopping around on stage saying, white people, you'll never have Britain back. And the media were fine with that. But when he said death to the IDF, he was basically investigated by the police, and he was blocked, or his visa. He actually had a visa to go and perform in America, and that was cancelled, wasn't it? So there does seem to be this unbelievable Atlantic treaty between America and the UK, that the one thing that will guarantee you a travel ban is saying something mean, or in this case, truthful, about Jewish power.
Yeah, that seems to be the only thing that gets you banned from going to the US. And over here, to be honest, any of your concerts, you can slag off anyone. Like you were saying, that Bob Billy, he said, I heard you want your country back, ha ha, you can't have it. Or something along the lines of that was what he was actually saying. And as you were saying, that's all absolutely fine to the media. It's almost celebrated, like there was laughing about it. But then he goes, death to the IDF, all of a sudden, it's media meltdown, this man's pure evil, he's a psychopath, we've got to get him cancelled, blah, 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 blah. Which, weirdly, it works as well. Obviously it works, but like weirdly, like it works with the way that I see so many normal people just going, oh my God, he said this about the IDF, and they was completely ignoring the fact that he was actually laughing about the fact that we're not having our country back. Like, to me, that's a lot more concerning than whatever he said about the IDF, which is just some foreign military. Like, yeah. So I don't understand how normal people can fall for the same tricks over and over and over again, but you see it happen all the time, and it's quite infuriating.
I think this double standard, though, extends onto social media. So there have been a number of people who have been arrested or at least reported to the police for saying things about the IDF. But I don't know if you saw, but Tommy Robinson tweeted out a crowd of Iranian civilians, and he was like, bomb them all. Why aren't we strafing these civilians with fighter jets? And it is incredible to see this happen, because I'm pretty sure that if you and I, or if you or I or both of us were to post a picture of, say, Israeli troops or even worse, Israeli civilians, and suggest that they deserved to be hit by a missile or a rocket or machine gun fire, I'm pretty sure that would be an arrestable offence. And we may even be looking at serious jail time for suggesting that a foreign country or a foreign military were harmed in any way. But people like Tommy Robinson can say, look at those civilians, bomb them all, just murder those civilians at will. And because those civilians are essentially seen as enemies of the Jewish state, it's just open season, isn't it? You can say what you want. And I quite like the Bob Villain thing. I don't like Bob Villain, but I liked the Bob Villain situation, because I thought it was a wonderful illustration of how white people are at the very bottom of the social totem pole. You know, you can say whatever you want about us, you can slag us off, you can say we don't even deserve a country, but one little whiff that, you know, Jewish soldiers should face resistance in places like Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, etc., and boom, you've got a full-on police investigation. Despite, you know, tabloids like the Daily Mail, you know, wishing death on Russian soldiers every day for sort of the past 2 or 3 years. But, you know, you say that a white soldier should die, that's cool. Say a Jewish soldier should die, knock, knock, here's the police. Can you please put your hands behind your back?
Well, this is the thing. It tells you everything you need to know about society, doesn't it? The fact that some people are okay to criticise whilst others are not. Obviously, it just shows you the amount of influence that the Jews actually hold over the country. And that's obviously, it's quite concerning, really, because if something as simple as just criticising them can even get you banned from the country. Imagine what you can do if you're actually openly hostile towards them. They're going to destroy your life. So, yeah, it's not a great situation. But like one thing I find quite promising, though, is a lot of people that used to be very pro-Israel are now very quiet on the issue. Rather, they're not so much opposing Israel now, but they're not so much publicly supporting them either. It's almost like it's a taboo now to be seen as, well, it is a taboo, but in normal circles now, it's more taboo to be pro-Israel because all of the stuff that they've done in Palestine and so on is bleeding out to like all of the public. Like, for instance, even my kids see stuff that goes on in Palestine on TikTok and things like that, and their opinion's obviously not positive.
So where do you think that's going to go, Steve? Because sort of at one point, people like myself were like these massive pariahs for talking about this issue of sort of Zionist or Jewish power. Now, it's actually quite popular to discuss that. And it's really interesting because obviously Rupert Lowe didn't come out in support of the war with Iran. Initially, Farage did, but Farage got such a cold reception for doing so. He walked that back pretty quickly, didn't he? And it was quite interesting because that seems to be dripping through into the mainstream. Now, I'm not suggesting that tomorrow we're going to have, you know, mainstream populist right parties on the ballot paper saying, you know, we need to cut ties with Israel. We need to start thinking of, you know, Britain first. And that means, you know, cut ties, etc. But it is interesting to see this. Now, future generations, especially young people, you say like your kids, have a completely different perspective on Israel to people of, say, the boomer generation, who were always very, very pro-Israel and thought Israel was this wonderful Western outpost that we had to protect at any cost. Do you think they've really overplayed their hand here to the point there's no coming back? Because I'm not sure how public opinion could actually swing back in their direction. Because you've got to remember, on October the 7th, whether you believe that that attack was genuine or a bit of a false flag, Israel seemed to have a lot of sympathy from the populist right and generally from white people in Britain. You know, 2, 3 years, 4 years later, however long it's been, that sympathy seems to have completely eroded or evaporated. And we're now in a position where I would say generally the population has a negative view of Israel. Where do you think this is going to go? Because my concern is we are seeing an awakening, but I think they'll try and dampen this with new anti-free speech laws, laws that specifically outlaw talking about Israel in a negative way, because that's what they're doing in France. So there's a Jewish lawmaker in France who is trying to push through new laws that equate talking negatively of Israel with anti-Semitism, which is obviously punishable under French law.
Well, I don't think it's going to be such a thing as they're putting some anti-free speech laws and it will just be nipped in the bud and that'll be the end of it. Because like these Zoomers, for instance, are like very intelligent with their propaganda. They make all of these edits, they make all of these memes, they make all of these little graphics and stuff. And it's not always so on the nose. And even if like something's banned, there's still ways to promote it. And I think that the cat's kind of out the bag now. Like you said, they had the sympathy around October the 7th when that event kicked off. But their retaliation and how they've played out, plus things like the Epstein files and so forth, have all sort of put a negative light onto Jewish behaviour. So most of the youth are, I would say, on both sides of the fence in terms of nationalists and the left. And they've both got a negative view of Israel. Even the foreigners in the country have negative views of Israel. So I think that's going to bleed through younger generations and that's just going to keep continuing. The same with the way anti-immigration rhetoric has just started bleeding down to the younger generations, because they're realizing that it does actually impact their lives and their future's pretty much non-existent if they don't get it under control. But even if you don't want to go as far as I would go and say total remigration, everyone sort of agrees that at a very minimum, immigration's got to be stopped. So I think it's going to be difficult for the establishment to, even if they put in legislation trying to silence people talking about like Jewish power and their influence and so on, all of that, I don't think it's going to be very effective. Even if you look at the way they tried to silence everyone through Southport, and they was literally throwing people into prison, it still didn't silence people from talking out. If anything, it just sort of escalated the conversation much further.
Well, that takes on nicely to the situation in Iran, because, you know, I'm looking at the Iranian situation now. And this is something that's worried me quite a bit, because, you know, you and I have talked about sort of Donald Trump before, and Donald Trump has very much been sort of quite a center of the populist right for some time. And a lot of populist right figureheads from around the world, including sort of people like Jared Taylor, Marine Le Pen, Nigel Farage, and some people in the AFD as well have very much gravitated towards Trump. But what seems to have actually destroyed Trump's standing with his voter base, and this is a shock to me, is this conflict in Iran. Now, at one point, I can see Americans getting very much behind a war in Iran. And there has been many, many predictions by people on the right. In fact, I remember Nick Griffin back in the BNP days saying Iran is next. Now, you know, saying Iran is next in, I don't know, 2006, and then 20 years later it happens. You can say the prediction was right, but, you know, saying that's like saying there's going to be another war, and then 30 years later there is, and you're like, oh, I predicted this 30 years ago. You know, it's not like he gave the day and date, is what I'm saying. But he did predict this, and people have been predicting this for many, many years. But one thing that shocked me is how unpopular this war has been. And in the last 24 hours, Trump has sort of come over like a mad king, hasn't he? You know, you watch things like Game of Thrones and you'll have a mad king, you know, with a dragon, and he'll be like, we will burn every kingdom, every child will be scorched, every civilization reduced to ash, people will bow to the dragon riders or they will die. And it's sort of like a bad guy speech in a fantasy, you know, fantasy setting. But that's actually Trump. That is Trump. And it's not Game of Thrones, it's real life. He's saying a civilization will be wiped off the map tonight. In fact, he said worse than that. He said a civilization will die. And this kind of insane rhetoric has actually put people off. And I know that Trump isn't on our side. I know he's a lackey of Israel. But do you think what Trump is doing is so egregious and so insane that it's actually bringing people around to an anti-Israel, anti-Zionist point of view?
Well, if you look back at the beginning of the year and late last year, he spent all of that time attacking Europe, saying he wants to annex Greenland. He was even attacking NATO soldiers, saying that when they was in Afghanistan, they all stayed a little back then, and all of this. So he's been making all of these digs towards Europe, and then goes full, like, gung-ho into this war in Iran that he knows he can't win, and then gets the ump when he realises that Europeans are not going to actually support him for a number of reasons. One, the fact that he's just a prick. Like, I never used to be what I'd call a Trump fan, but I never used to be anti-Trump or anything like that. I used to just sort of see he had his roles, he'd help like move things along a little bit. But like seeing how he's played out over the last year or so, it just makes me like really dislike the bloke. The way he talks about Europe as a whole, for one, to the attitude where he generally thinks he's like the commander in chief of the world. He thinks he can literally dictate what he wants to do anywhere in the world, and that's what's going to happen. Obviously, you've got all of the Israelis and the Jews that he's pretty much dancing along to. you put all of those combinations together and it just makes him like a very unlikable person. And he was never very popular amongst normal people anyway, because of the way the media would always portray him anyway. So it's not hard for the media to now make him look like the devil to the average person who's not exactly very clued up on politics. So from that position, I think he's pretty much done in terms of popular opinion. It'd need a miracle to change it now, I think.
Yeah, I think you will. But you see, my hope fundamentally is that Trump gets absolutely destroyed in the midterms in America. I mean destroyed. And it leads to impeachment. And it leads to sort of the destruction of his establishment, his administration. Because I do want to see a crumbling of both Labour and the Tories here. And also a complete destruction of both the Democrats and the Republicans in America. I blame both sides of the House, both here and abroad, for the political mess we're in. And I just find it very interesting that this is kind of the hill he chose to die on. And I think he is going to die on this hill. I think this is the thing for him, because, you know, a lot of his let's get me elected again for a second time was all built around Biden's insane. He's got dementia. He's not a normal human being. This guy can't be trusted. You've got to put the power back in my hands and I'm going to make America great again. I'm going to deal with immigration. Hasn't done it. I'm going to do the deportations. Hasn't done it. I'm going to kickstart the economy. Everything's more expensive now than it was when he came to power. And I'm going to be the president of peace. Well, Venezuela, Greenland, threatening numerous countries. Now we're in Iran. Petrol prices sky high. But my concern is this, Steve. All over Europe, we have seen a rise of sort of populist anti-immigration rhetoric. But globally, populist anti-immigration rhetoric is very much tied to Donald Trump. And you and I both know that one of the things that's historically stopped older whites from voting for outsider parties, especially populist right or nationalist parties, is older whites fear instability. They fear a recession. They fear economic instability. They fear their house prices going down. And they've always stuck with the mainstream because of that. They've always said, look, we've got to vote Labour. We've got to vote Tories. Because once you go outside of the established political dichotomy, you can damage the system. And damaging the system, despite them not really liking what the system does, puts them personally and financially at risk. And they're scared of that. Now, here is Trump, the living embodiment of populism, the man that many, many populist leaders in Europe have sort of clung to and endorsed. And he has actually caused the problems that the media warned populism would cause. My concern about this is that Trump's madness is going to trickle down, and it could well affect parties like the AfD, the Front National, Reform, Restore, and parties that could actually do something to curtail mass immigration. And the other thing that Trump's done with his deportations, by using this kind of, you know, militia rather than, you know, proper uniformed officers and people who look like officers of the law, he has made a certain number of whites, not me, but a certain number of whites, squeamish about the issue of remigration and deportations. And my question for you, Steve, is, do you think this will have an effect? Do you think this is kind of like the thing that makes the boomers think, well, I was flirting with a populist party, but everything I thought might go wrong is going wrong, so I'm going to have to scuttle back to the mainstream? And do you think that's part of Trump's plan? Do you think Trump was, you know, is he a buffoon, or was he put in there to sort of wreck things for an emerging populist right-wing wave that was, you know, taking place all over the world?
That's a tricky one to say that he's doing it intentionally. That's not to say he's not. I wouldn't say hand on heart that's what I think it is. I think a lot of it is just ego and power, and I think that runs away with it, as well as obviously he's always trying to appease to his donors and his lobby groups. So I think that plays a lot of damage onto. But in terms of stuff like using the militia to carry out the deportations and stuff, that didn't help really. Like, obviously it looks good. Like, for us, we wouldn't care about it. Like, if anything, I would encourage it. But if you want to be, if you're going to be the first country carrying out like a process of remigration, you want everything to be going as smoothly as possible. You don't want to be going to, another thing he done wrong as well is go to these big sanctuary cities and put on a huge show, allowing all of the people that would oppose these deportations to then stand there and make huge protests that would go all around the world and everyone would see it. Whereas if you just went to the small towns first, picked off all of those areas and then waited for the cities towards the end, people would understand that there's going to be resistance in the cities then. But if you start with resistance, it makes people, like you say, squeamish. They think, oh, this isn't actually going to go as smoothly as before. It was, I'm going to back out of this, I'm not interested. But I don't think it's going to damage the like the European right-wing parties as such, because we're in a different situation to the Americans in terms of demographics. And I think we have a more, very, although they're in a worse situation than us, overall in Europe as a whole, there's sort of, from at least on the right, there's sort of a mutual agreement that we don't want to be demographically replaced. Even the Civnats don't want to be demographically replaced. They just don't have the stomach to actually push back and say this is the solution, because it may affect someone they know. But overall, from what I've seen anyway, the youth in Europe are very much either heavily left wing to the point that they're never going to be fixed, or they're nationalists. They're not really, I'm not really seeing many youngsters that are sort of floating around in the middle. There are some, of course, but there's not many.
You made a really good point there, and I just want to pick up on it, because Trump does have red states. Now, I know it's different in America. Like, we see red as the left, but over there, red is Republican, blue is Democrat. But there are red states that are diehard Trump-supporting states. And those diehard Trump-supporting states, Trump hasn't sent people there to get the illegals out. He's gone to the blue states and poured his militias into the blue states that have antagonized things. Now, let's say he'd gone to a red state and done this. Firstly, going to a red state and doing this would actually help him in terms of the next round of elections or the midterms, because number one, he's actually delivering to the people who voted for him. But number two, he's reducing the number of people who would vote against him in those states. And it's kind of that thing where, when people vote for you, you want to in some way reward them for doing so. But instead, he went to blue states and did this. And it's almost as if, okay, it's a buffoonish move. It was a stupid move. And by going to these blue states, as you so rightly said, he's had more resistance than he would have otherwise had. Now, here's the issue. Trump is not an idiot. And I, one thing I hate is when people say, these politicians are just idiots, because that absolves them of doing the stupid things they've done. Because if you're an idiot, you're not actually culpable for the stupid things you did. It's just written off and you get away with it. Like, oh, ho, ho, this guy's an idiot, you know, silly little man, get him out of here. Whereas if you did things that were wrong and you did them by design, that means you're far more culpable. It means you're actually part of a plot against us. And I don't believe Trump's an idiot for 1 minute. And what I'm getting at is, bearing in mind that he isn't an idiot, that he is an intelligent man and a successful man as well, why on earth would a successful, intelligent man send what were obviously caricature-style militias into blue states rather than policing migration fairly in red states? Because let's face it, if you said to me, we're splitting Britain tomorrow. Okay. The first condition is we split Britain tomorrow. The South, sorry, Steve, is going to be full of all leftists, liberals, LGBTs, multiculturalists, every freak, and every left leaning person imaginable. The North, on the other hand, is going to be full of, at worst, you know, conservative types, at best, all the hardcore nationalists and ethno-nationalists are going to move up north. So you're coming up north and you're living on my street. And the second condition is I'm going to be in charge of how the country's run. Well, I'd be like, so the north is full of all white people, nationalists, conservatives, patriots, you know, populist right, dissidents, whatever you want to call them. And the south is full of all these liberals, multiculturalists. I would be straight away, let's move all the migrant hotels, all the immigrants, all of the people who shouldn't be here to the south, so the liberals can live in the multicultural utopia they claim they desired. And we, the horrible, white, racist, ethno-nationalists, we'll have to live in the horrible, boring, pale, stale, ethnically homogenous, safe north where we're around our own people. And the reason I do that is because, number one, I'd want the left to deal with the issues that they created and said they wanted to live amongst. And number two, I'd want us to be safe and happy. So the comparison as time went by was more and more obvious. You'd say living in the south is a living hell. Living in the north is great. You want to move north if you're white and you want your family to prosper. And if you go south, you're going to be in big trouble because you're living in multicultural Britain. But if you want to live in ethnically homogenous Britain, you come north. Trump seems to be doing the opposite, doesn't he? Trump is like, well, I'm going to go into the liberal, left-leaning areas with my militia, and I'm going to try and get rid of the immigrants there. No, you'd want to, if anything, you'd want to collect the immigrants from the red states, ship them to the blue states and say, Democrats, you deal with the mess you created. And I can't see him doing this by accident. He's getting it all wrong, but he isn't an idiot, is he? He's not some sub 70 IQ moron that doesn't know what he's doing. Why is he getting this game of chess so badly wrong?
Well, this is the thing, that there's only two answers for why he's getting it wrong. It's either intentional or he's retarded. But not, like you say, none of us believe he's retarded unless he's just getting terrible, terrible advice from his advisors and his associates. But even then, you can't have that many people being retarded all at the same time, all coming up with the same wrong solution. So it must be intentional. Because as you say, you would focus on the red states. You would make sure that everything's prim and proper in those areas. So when your term is up, you can go, look, in the 4 years, look what they're living amongst. Look what we're living amongst. Life is much better in the red states because there's no immigration and so on and so forth. That's how it should have been done. But as you can see, it's gone the complete opposite way. We'll have to see in like the years to come if it's actually damaged like the mass deportations movement in the long term. But he also did get the ball rolling, even if it was just in terms of propaganda and showing small snippets of immigrants being deported. He did get the ball rolling there. So it did give a lot of confidence to other nations to adopt tougher rhetoric. For instance, as soon as he did that, the AfD went a lot stronger on remigration. So it did have a trickle down effect, but I'm hoping it doesn't have a trickle down effect for the downfall of Trump, if that makes sense, because he's obviously going to get battered in the midterms and his legacy is going to be absolute mud. The longer this Iran conflict goes on as well, the worse it's going to be for him. So hopefully it doesn't have a trickle down effect again, where it leads to parties like Restore or Reform being a bit cautious about deportations. Although I don't think these parties really want to entertain that situation, because the only sort of pushback they're receiving lately is on immigration positions, especially in the UK. I'm not so sure on how it's happening in Europe, because I'm not fully up to date on what all of like the public are saying over there. But in terms of the UK, if Reform or Restore say something that's not very what I would class as the position everyone wants, they get absolutely battered for it. So that's a positive development. That means that the country's ready for tougher immigration policies, because as soon as they're not offered something that they like, they reject it immediately.
Thank you. You're pretty much saying the same as me. And that's, you know, we're going to move to the super chats now, but that's my worry. You know, Trump has been this sort of central pole to the populist right movement, and every decision he has made has strengthened and emboldened other groups. So Farage said he wants to be, did he say he wanted to be the deporter in chief, you know, sort of joking that, you know, Trump was doing it, so why can't he? The AFD did the same. I believe Marine Le Pen sort of tried to snuggle under his wing as well, and certainly enjoyed the support of Elon Musk. But, you know, if you are going to wed yourself to Trump, as some of these people have done, how do you unwed yourself when he crashes the movement? That's the issue. You know, if you're all on board the Trump train, it's all well and good when the train's sort of, you know, sailing round those bends at speed and it seems like you're going places. But when the train hits that rock on the track and derails, well, unfortunately, you know, if you're one of the carriages hitched to his engine, decoupling as he's going flying through the countryside and coming into a rock face because he's derailed, it's very hard at that point to uncouple and go your own way, isn't it? And I think we're going to face an issue going forward where, for numerous reasons, Trump will have unfortunately not only sowed the seeds of his demise, but could well have damaged everything that we stand for. And as I said, you know, he does work for one particular ethnic group. So, you know, whether he's done this openly by design himself or been maneuvered into this position by others who have designed this to be the outcome, I don't know. But I would find it very difficult to believe that this wasn't done by design. Anyway, we're going to do the super chats now. Thank you to everyone who's donated so generously tonight. I really, really do appreciate everything that people give. If you want to give something, please do. We still have half of the show left. If you can donate generously, it is really, really appreciated. As I said, things have been a bit difficult with the entropy money not coming through and other stuff like that. We've had these problems. We've been assured that it is working and we will get the money eventually. So if you would like to donate via entropy, it is very kind of you to do so. You can donate through Rumble. And remember, everything that you give, that is what keeps me working full time for this movement, doing all the things I do. I've started a Substack recently as well. I'm going to be uploading all my old articles. I've basically been writing articles and producing scripted videos for a decade now. Well, a decade exactly, at the end of October this year. So I've got a decade's worth of material. You know, something like 300-400 good articles that I'm going to be uploading to my Substack. A lot of people put their Substacks behind paywalls and demand that people pay to read the articles as an archive. I won't be doing that. Everything I do is free. So if you can donate, and if you like the work I do, if you like the work I do helping arrange demonstrations, dealing with the police, doing all the work I do, please do consider making a donation. The first one is from Nationless Nationalist. Thank you so much. And he said, appreciate your content. Well, thank you very much. And that was for $3. Open Borders for Israel gave £5. Thank you so much. And sorry, $5, and said the festival got cancelled after Kanye was not allowed into the UK. To know who rules over you, just identify who you can't criticise. How many anti-white and anti-Christian performers can perform at British festivals? The answer, all of them. Well, that is something that we've covered extensively tonight. And yes, we agree with you. Aunt Sally gave $5. Thank you so much. She said, thank you, Mark and Steve. Got to watch on catch up. Well, thank you so much, Aunt Sally. It's really appreciated. Thank you for your continued support. Delta Troiske, 125, gave $5. Thank you so much. And said, help support Mark and send some coin. He brings us great shows every week with interesting guests. Well, thank you so much. Skins 88 gave $5 with the critical super chat. Thank you so much. He said, Mark, my man, what's with this anti-alcohol crusade all of a sudden? That's some next level lameness right there. You're basically urinating on centuries of glorious British culture. As proud whites, we should be all about that jock culture, man. Well, I disagree with you, and it's not a new thing. I am totally against drinking. I gave up drinking almost completely before my daughter was born. I rarely drank before that anyway. I've always found drinking to be one of the worst things. It's so expensive. It makes a mess of you. You say and do stupid things when you're drunk. and you mortgage the day of your life after the night you were drinking so you can sit in bed feeling ill because you overindulge. But if you want to do it, it's up to you. I don't drink. I don't spend my money frivolously. And I've committed to sort of a life of sobriety with my family, but also a life of fundamentally training, going to the gym, staying fit. I'm 45. And I've got to tell you this. I'm 45 and I'm proud I don't drink. I'm not saying I'm the youngest looking 45-year-old. I'm not saying I'm the fittest 45-year-old. But I can say this. I am a 45-year-old that is markedly fitter than the average 45-year-old. And that's because I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't use drugs, I don't smoke weed. Definitely don't smoke weed. I keep myself clean. I eat as healthily as I can. My only vice is really drinking the energy drink so I can sustain my high work rate and keep doing these shows and guest appearances. And I also think drink is something that needs to be really purged from the nationalist movement. After 20 something years doing this and 20 years fighting for our people, I can honestly say one of the single worst problems in the nationalist culture or the nationalist movement or nationalist parties that I've been in is the drink culture. It ruins it. The amount of events I've seen ruined by people knocking each other's lights out or falling out, the amount of demos where we'd have had an extra 50, 100, 200 people if they hadn't just sat in the pub because it looks slightly gloomy outside. So I'm going to sit in the pub and have another 10 pints. That's my day of activism. Well, it's not activism. It's crap. And this is the problem. If we want a strong, disciplined nationalist movement, we need to get rid of the drinking culture. I used to remember Red, White and Blues. Every year somebody'd end up getting punched, somebody's wife would end up getting off with somebody else's husband, there'd always be drama, nastiness, and as I got older I saw the damage this was causing both people and our movement. And the other problem is, you know, alcohol has done so much damage to our community too. You know, you look at people who are dads, you look at people who are mothers that are addicted to this stuff. It's bad. We need it out of the nationalist movement. If you want to do it at home in your own time, great. But don't, please don't bring it to our events. You know, one of the biggest things we've had to do is get these demos cleared up from alcohol. You know, and I'm gonna go off on one now because this is something I absolutely hate to see. When you're at one of these nationalist demos and you're watching people walk down the street with bags, the bags that you get from like the corner shop, they call them vest bags. They're white bags with sort of blue or red stripes down them, and they're walking down the street with a vest bag full of tinnies, just cracking them open, flag being used as a cape, tinny in the hand, you know, roll up fag in the other hand. And by the end of the day, they're completely paralytic. They don't know what's happened. I mean, I remember speaking to Joe Marsh about this, and he told me about a demo in Blackpool where it was raining lightly. And he said they had hundreds of people there, and most of them stayed in the pub because there was light rain and they were enjoying the beer too much. That is not what's going to save our people. What's going to save our people is a sober, disciplined group that knows that if it's a social, they can drink in moderation. But if it's a political event, turn up sober, act sensibly, and don't make a disgrace of yourself. That's the rules, you know. Or alternatively, we can have an absolute circus and go back to the old days of drunken, shambolic marches, which is not where I want to be. What's your thoughts of drunkenness in the movement, Steve?
Well, I have a fonder view on drinking than you, I suppose. But in terms of the movement, yeah, like, don't turn up at a demo pissed up. Don't be marching down the street with a can of beer in your hands. Like, that should be a no-brainer now. Like you say, the more organised and disciplined you are, the more people actually listen to us, the more they're actually may actually take action on our concerns. I have been to like nationalist events where people have been drinking and I have had a good time. So I'd be a hypocrite to say that we shouldn't have drinking at nationalist events. But in terms of protests and things like that, anything that's happening on the street, I don't think it should, people should be drinking. Like, that's when you should be there for the protests and things like that. But if it's, say there's an event going on, there's a conference, and then after everyone's having a drink and stuff, I don't see an issue with that. Obviously, don't get to the point where you're like fighting everyone in the street, being paralytic, but I don't see a point of it, problem with people having a few drinks like after an event like that. I think that's fine.
And just to clarify, we do have a bar at our conferences after the speeches, but that's another thing. You know, I remember BNP events, BNP conferences, people, you know, going to the bar and draining it during the speeches. You know, we don't allow that. If you come to one of our conferences, the bar opens at 6:30 with dinner for those who have paid to stay for dinner. But we do not allow people to just hover around the event drinking all day. If you're at a conference, you're there to meet people, to help build a community, to listen to the speakers. You're not there to get hammered, you know. And if that's what you are there for, to get hammered, you know, there was probably a pub down the road where you can do that. But, you know, we've got to be serious about this. We've got, what, 25 years in Britain till we're a minority. And if you can't put down the beer for an event, for a day, for a protest, when we've got 25 years left, that's a you problem. It's not a me problem. It's as simple as that. And, you know, I personally, as I said, have sort of purged it from my life as a way to sort of clean up, stay healthy, and be more of an inspiration, you know, for my children as well, because I don't want them. I don't want my son. I don't want my daughter getting into this drinking habit that I see some younger Britons get into, where you see these kids out on the street at night, you know, downing drinks around the bus shelters or in the parks. That's not what I want for them. I don't want them to think that the be-all and end-all of sort of adult fun is having beer. You know, I'm very passionate about setting a good example for them, and I think that's part of it. But as I said, if you want to do it in moderation at the right time. You know, that's really how I see things. You know, and if people don't like that, well, sorry, but that's how I feel about it. Dare Cheruska gave $5, thank you so much, and said, another good episode. The struggle continues. Jobless Nationalist gave $50. Thank you so much for your support, and said, hello, Mark. I missed the last show with Blair, but wanted to ask this. Do you know who Michael Nelson is? He's been saying that young whites should invest their time into culture / politics instead of getting a job. Do you believe that young nationalists should prioritise working, or should we go all in on politics? Young and jobless, by the way, so I'm curious. Well, thank you so much for the $50. It's extremely generous of you. I'd say this, my advice for any young nationalist is simple. Stay clean, stay away from the drink and the drugs, eat healthy, go to the gym, so you're in the perfect mental and physical place, and get a job. But don't get a job where you're reliant on others. There are people out there today working as electricians, working as skilled plasterers, tradesmen, people out there who are plumbers, and they are making good money, really good money. People are always going to need somebody to come in and block their toilet. They're always going to need somebody to come and fix their electrics. People are always going to need, like, a handyman or a bricklayer. People are always going to need someone who can do these trades, and trades are so important. Labour government tried to kill trades back between 97 and 2010. They have this big push, get everyone into the universities, get everyone doing a humanities degree, get everyone doing a human science degree, you know, tourism management. It was all a complete waste of time. And you have these people being churned out from a university system that actually didn't have any skills. And then they all ended up in call centres. They all ended up, you know, not that there's anything wrong with being in a call centre or working as a waiter or anything like that, but doing these jobs. And I think they'd have been a lot better off getting a real skill, getting a real trade, doing something that people will always, always need, and that pays very well, but also lets you be the master of your own destiny. If you're a self-employed plumber, if you're a self-employed locksmith, if you're a self-employed plasterer, there's always going to be people who want you to work for them. But you'll also, if you don't like working for other people, you'll be able to just say, right, I'm putting an advert up. I'm going to say, right, 30 quid an hour, plastering work, and get out there and do it. These jobs are important. Having skills are important. And I think saying that young people should go all in on culture and politics, it sounds good on paper. Oh, do what Colette did, you know, go all in on politics. Well, I can tell you, it's a very hard road to do that. It is not very financially secure, as people can see and as people know. I don't make a huge amount of money. You know, it's not always easy for me and my family. It's a very hard road to walk, those who have done it. I wouldn't tell any young people to follow in my footsteps. It's not all fun and games. It's not all live streams and laughter. It's very, very tough. And, you know, if you're a young person and you're passionate about this movement, get a trade and set yourself up so you can't be sacked for having the wrong opinions, but so you have skills that wherever you go in this country or in the world, you will be in demand. You'll be able to make money. But most importantly, you'll be the master of your own destiny, because you won't need an employer. If you want, just set up and do it yourself. That's the best advice. And if I went back and spoke to young Mark, the younger version of me, I'd have lots of choice advice. But one great piece of advice would be, get a trade. And that's what I'd say to all young people now. I don't know what you think about that, Steve. Are you encouraging young people to give up their jobs and get involved in the movement?
No, don't do that. Definitely don't do that. You're not going to earn any money. That's the main issue, especially, like, the problem is a lot of these youngsters are going to want families, and they're going to want to eventually have their own place to live rather than living at home or house sharing or whatever it is they're doing. And you're not going to be able to afford that if you're just working in politics. Like, of course, some people do get lucky. They get like a YouTube channel that'll blow up and they make an absolute fortune, or they might get the chance to like work for some media outlet or something. But that's very slim and like rare opportunities, especially for people who hold our positions, for instance. It's not going to be a lot easier. So I'm one of these people who went out when I was younger and got a trade. Like, I'm paint and decorator. I'm also qualified as a carpenter. But I still, to this day, work in those trades alongside politics. And I've been a face-out activist for about 7 years now. I've got quite a huge platform and stuff, but it doesn't pay the bills. So if you are a youngster and you want to get involved in the movement and you want to like get heavily involved, the advice Mark gave you is probably what I would give you as well, to be honest. Learn a skill or a trade that you can apply anywhere in the country, and you can start your own business overnight. So say you learn to be a plumber or a painter or something, you can literally just print out some leaflets, go and hand them around an area that you live in, and then before you know it, you're getting people call you up asking for a quote or some work, and you can go off from there. But if you commit heavily into just politics, although we do need to be in a situation where we have a lot of our guys working just in politics, we have no infrastructure surrounding us at the moment that can actually apply that. So we can't put our best and our brightest nationalists into full-time nationalist work, because there's nothing there for them to go into. There's no think tanks. There's no media outlets that's going to recruit these people. There's no... There's just nothing in place. Like, even in the European scene, there's nothing really in place for people to jump into these roles. It's only really in America that they have that sort of in place where you can jump in the movement and then you can sort of work as a podcaster, or you could work in one of these think tanks or one of these lobby groups or whatever. But in the UK, there's really nothing there for us in nationalists. Unless you come into politics and you want to be a Tory, then it's a different ballgame. But if you're coming into politics to go full-time as a nationalist, you're definitely going to need another income behind you. So I would definitely advise you to get a skill or a trade.
Well, we're definitely on the same page there. And like I said, when I came into nationalist politics, there was a huge amount of pressure upon people like me and young people of the day to be face out, to put themselves forward, to give their all to politics. And it's been a very difficult road for me. One day I might talk about it all. But of the intake of young people that came in my generation, so sort of like, you know, the year of 2000/2001 kind of era people, I'm the only one left. I'm the only one still doing it. I'm sure many of the people who've dropped out still feel the same way about this cause as I do and as we do, the people watching this stream. But it is very, very difficult and it takes its toll. It's certainly done that to me. So I will not be following in the footsteps of my predecessors by encouraging young people to go face out and to give everything for the cause, because I don't want to see anybody face the kind of struggles that people like myself and others have faced in the past. You know, not being able to have a bank account, not being able, you know, to travel abroad, you know, everywhere you go, you're basically dogged for it. And that can break people down. Now, I've dealt with that throughout my life. I'm still dealing with it now, but I certainly will not be giving what I feel was the wrong advice given to me by people in the movement at the time, which was like, get out there, get your face out, give it all. And, you know, it makes it very difficult. And I know people who have tried to sort of go back to real life after the movement because they just couldn't hack the pressure that you're under. And they found it very difficult to do that. So, you know, be very careful about what you're doing. If you're a young person, you know, please, please take my sage advice. Bad Optics 777 gave $5. Thank you so much. And said, I just want to say this, Mark, I did smoke weed a lot for a year before because a cousin pressured me to, and I regret that. I'm still worried to this day that my brain is permanently damaged in some way from weed because I'm young, but I'm sober now. Well, look, congratulations on your sobriety, and I'm pleased you gave it up. It's true that weed does have a bad effect on people's brains, and especially if you start young. But generally speaking, that damage is reversible somewhere between 2 days, and it begins to reverse somewhere between 2 days and 3 weeks after you've used the drugs. But you have to stay off them. And the longer you stay off them, the more you stay healthy, the more exercise you get, the more you clean up your body, you can reverse that. I mean, obviously, if you totally railed it when you were very young, you might end up with lasting damage, sort of lasting paranoia and things like that. And I hope that's not the case with you. I hope you get through this. And look, I've dealt with numerous people who've had problem with alcohol. And this is one of the things I do in my spare time. And this is why I'm so harsh on drinking. I deal sometimes on a daily basis with people who have struggled with alcohol, who have had their lives ruined through alcoholism. And it's tragic. You're dealing with people who are lovely people, have got so much to offer the world, but have this stumbling block. And when you're in a position like I am, where your number's out there, your email's out there, and in some cases, I've had people ringing me at 7 in the morning, and they've walked in from a bender, they're absolutely gone, and they realize that they've messed up because they were sober for several weeks or months and they've just gone back on it, and they're ringing your head in their hands. I see this firsthand with what I do. And look, these conversations, you know, people don't see this side of what I do, but I am here to help you if you've got problems with alcohol or drugs. Email me, mark@thefallthewesternman. I will always give out my number to people who need it. And if you call for a chat because you're in a bad place with any of these things, it's not a paid service. I am here to help people who need that. That's something I do as part of my patriotic alternative community building work. So if you are going through these things, you don't have to send a super chat. You can ring me, you can email me, and I am here to help. So if you need me, do reach out. And I've helped people in the past who have been dealing with these problems. So please do reach out if you need help. Delta Troisker 125 gave $5. Thank you so much. Said people that drink in the street represent the idiocy of today. Well, unfortunately, you do see people behaving like that more and more. And one of the things that bothers me, I don't know if this annoys you, Steve, but I've seen increasingly people smoking weed in the street. You take your kids to the park and there's, you know, there's a gang of young lads just smoking weed. I was I was at supermarket the other week by the InPost lockers, you know, doing a couple of returns for the wife. I was there with my daughter. There was two teenage lads just leaning against the lockers smoking weed. Well, at that point, what do you do? I mean, I could have, personally, I'd have been happy to punch them both in the face, you know, and stamp out their spliff. But, you know, what's your thoughts on that? Just people who just casually smoke drugs in public?
It's one of those things. It's just, it seems to be a lot more common than when I was a kid, if I'm honest with you. I see it a lot more now than I. But then that might have just been the naivety of being young. It could have always been like this. I don't know. I've never really paid too much attention. It is frustrating, especially if you're out for like a meal or something, or you've got the kids with you. Then like it's a lot worse. But it's like you kind of get used to it. Like it's everywhere, isn't it?
It's really sad because I've said this many times. I was having a private conversation with somebody today and said, look, you know, it's one thing, you know, we've got to get rid of all the immigrants. But then what do we do to raise up the white people who have fallen into this pit of, you know, alcohol, gambling, you know, drug abuse? There's so many of our people that need genuine help and need structures to pull them out of this sort of swamp of negativity that they're embroiled in. Makes me very sad to see people like that. Makes me even more sad to see kids brought up in households like that. You know, imagine if you're a child and every day you're brought up around parents who are puffing weed in your face, you know, from the age of being a newborn baby, you know, what hope do you have? You know, I feel really sad. I feel really sad about that. You know, having two kids of my own, I look at other children and think, you know, every kid, or, you know, all of our people, every white British child, I want to see being given the best start in life, you know, a clean home, you know, a warm, clean bed at night, free from sort of their parents, you know, abusing them in any way, or, you know, puffing cannabis smoke in their face. It's very, very sad. And we need a complete overhaul of our society. You know, on every level, you know, the issue now isn't just the migrants. It's kind of this societal decline. I know you're Mr. sort of remigration, Steve, but I mean, how do you view the general societal decline of Britain? You know, the fact that everywhere you go now, there's just litter piling up. You know, I was walking past a litter bin at a bus stop today and somebody had chucked a can of Foster's into the hedge. Why not just put it in the bin? Why? You know, personally, you know, if I was Grand Emperor of Britain and I saw somebody throwing a can of Foster's in a hedge when they could have just placed it in the litter bin, I'd happily take them out to the public square and see them thrashed within an inch of their life in front of a baying crowd for being such a complete antisocial retard.
Yeah, that'd be funny to see you do that. In terms of like how we reverse the decline, I'm not 100% sure, to be honest with you, because a lot of it seems to just slowly keep creeping on and on and on. Especially, it's definitely a generational thing as well. The younger generation seems to care a lot less. But then you can push back on that and say, well, they haven't really got much of a future, so why are they going to really care about their surroundings and so forth? And that probably does play a part to it. And like how they sort of carry themselves on. But then that's not saying that all the young people are the main problems, because a lot of people my age, for instance, are just as bad. It's like I've got friends that think nothing of just chucking a bit of rubbish on the floor rather than just waiting 2 seconds until you see a bin down the road. So it's a problem that goes all the way through society, I think. And there's no real repercussions for it. Like, say you chuck a bit of rubbish on the floor, no one's going to come and sort of reprimand you for that. Nothing's going to happen, unless maybe you do it in front of a police officer and they might turn around and say, oh, you picked that up. But other than that, there's no real punishment. Like, I'm pretty sure when I was younger, you'd get like a £50 fine uptown for like throwing a fag butt on the town, for like throwing a fag butt on the ground or something. That like there doesn't seem to be anything like that now, unless I'm just missing it in because I live down south in like a quiet town. But there doesn't seem to be anything like that.
No, I was actually said this to somebody the other day, during the 80s, when I was brought up, there was two things that I remember. One was keep Britain tidy, and the other was don't be a little out. And there was like this social shame for, you know, chucking your cans and, you know, crisp wrappers out in nature. It was just unthinkable. And, you know, if you did it and somebody saw you, somebody'd say, oi, what are you doing there, mate? Pick that up. You know, and as a kid, you know, if you did that, you'd expect other adults and people to pull you up on it. Now, you go to the park and you see these sort of families sat there in the park having a picnic. They get up, shake the blanket off, crisp packets, you know, chocolate biscuit wrappers, cans just rolling off on the grass, get up and leave. I mean, one thing that appalled me a couple of summers ago was we went to the beach up in Cleethorpes. It's a really nice little, like, traditional seaside town. I like those sort of places. And it really upset me just to see families going and buying the plastic beach toys and then packing up their stuff and just leaving, you know, oh, well, we spent £5 on the beach toys, sod it, it's only a fiver, and just leaving them there on the beach. So the beach is just littered with plastic waste. Like, why? You know, if you don't want to keep it, there's bins all down the beach. Why not just...
They do that in my town. I live not too far from a beach, and the amount of people that they get the train down to Folkestone, so they must be either coming from, like, Essex or London or something. They just come down to the beach. They go to, like, all of, like, the little tourist shops that we have along the, like, the seafront. But at the end of the day, there's just buckets and spades left everywhere, and it's so frustrating. And it's usually out of town. It's like, it's not to say that everyone from my town picks theirs up and takes it back, but it's usually out of towners from from what I've seen down my way.
It is sad. Anyway, we'll move on. It Was Made Up gave $10 and said, keep up the good work. Well, thank you so much. I'm pleased you're enjoying the stream. CPO Roy gave $25. Thank you so much. And said, support Mark, Laura, Sam and the PA team. Honest, genuine people who want the best for the people of Great Britain. Well, thank you so much for your support. It's really appreciated. Reese Beast 310 gave $5 and said, Nuneaton was a great event. Thanks, Mark. Well, thank you to you. And thank you to everyone who turned up at Nuneaton. It was a great event. But I think me and Steve would both underline this, that these events are only fantastic events if people turn up and make them fantastic events. And I want nationalism to sort of be clean and sober, like I said, but I also want it to be more of a participation sport rather than a sit at home and watch it sport. And it kind of annoys me when I see five different streamers streaming it. And like one of the streams got 39,000 views for Nuneaton. And it must have had like 1,000+ people watching live. And that's just one of the streams. And you feel like saying, come on, guys, if you're one of those 1,000 people watching the stream, please, please, you know, rather than just sit there watching the stream, why don't you just jump on the bus or the train or whatever? These events are once every sort of 6 weeks. Get off the couch and get off the bench. Join us. Because, you know, if just half of that sort of 1,500 people had joined us at Nuneaton, would have had well over 1,000. And it would have been just, you know, chef's kiss. It would have been the numbers we deserved. What do you think to that, Steve? Because these streams and these auditors and the people producing this constant content are getting thousands of people watching, but we need them there with us, don't we?
Yeah, this is the thing. It's great to have like the sign of support in terms of thousands of people watching it. That's all good to see, but I'd much rather those people are standing with us on the street. Because like obviously they're not easy things to organise. Obviously you can take a lot of the credit for it because you do all of the organising in terms of dealing with the council and the police and all of that side of thing. I personally just crap at it, so it's not my expertise. But a lot of effort goes into these events, like, and we're trying our best to make it so it's a nationalist, like a purely a nationalist protest movement. None of this SIBNAT nonsense. None of this dancing with foreigners or any of that malarkey. So it's going to take a lot more time to get the numbers as high as like what you'd see with some of these SIBNAT demos, because anyone can turn up at one of those protests. You don't really even need to be politically aligned. Like, it's not just all Civnets at those events. There's a lot of normal people that are in London and stuff, and there's also a lot of our guys go to those events and stuff. So to get those numbers, it's going to take an awful lot of time, which means we need as many of our people that agree with us to stand with us, to show the rest of the public that, yeah, it is normal to hold these positions. Look how many people are here with that position. And then it will escalate from there. That's why it's vital to have a street movement in the first place, because it shows the general public that there is support for this position and there's a growing number of people supporting it. And that's why it's important for every nationalist to come. So when we announce our next one, the more people that come, the better. We had more at the last demo than we had at the one before. So it's a sign of growth, but it would be nice to see it doubled rather than just an extra 50 or 100 people.
It would. And it would also be nice if people stuck around for the whole time. I know that sounds like a bit critical. That's probably, people probably say I've been very critical tonight because I've had to go at weed smokers, drunks, and now I'm having to go at people who don't stay for the whole demo. I'm not really having to go. I'm just giving genuine advice. But, you know, if you are there, please stick around as well, because a lot of people move through the demo. They have a chat with everyone and they're like, oh, we've got to get off. But it is great to see people, you know, there for the whole thing, because you want that big pop, don't you, when the speeches begin. And, you know, I'm just very passionate about getting this right, because I've spent the last few years saying, look, politics via the parliamentary ballot box system is dead for us. And I've been proved right. And I've said what we need is advocacy, community and activism. And a central pillar of activism is this big street movement. And for so long, ethno-nationalists have been pushed off the streets, not solely by the Reds, but actually by the Civnats. You know, we have been sidelined by, you know, the Tommy Robinson movement. We've been sidelined by these very, you know, multicultural and multiracial versions of the right, which we don't feel represents our people properly. But now we're building this. We need your help, you know, not, you know, in terms of just watching the demo as it goes on a YouTube stream, but by actually being there. And hopefully by the time we get to summer, those numbers will rise. So I hope more people will be with us. Kalergi gave $10. Thank you so much. He said, Britons, no, the world's only hope is David Lammy. He is the one who sees the big picture. I know eventually Zuma and Steve will see reason and back our gift from Wakanda. Hail Lammy. What do you think to this, Steve? Is David Lammy our one true hope?
Hail Lammy from Wakanda. No, he's obviously going to get deported, isn't he? he's literally, what is he? Is he like Caribbean or something? I don't know where he's from. He's clearly not English, but I have no idea. Somewhere in Africa or like Jamaica or something.
He doesn't get the window seat, does he? That's all I want to know.
No, he's getting a horrible aisle seat, and he's going to go next to Based and Bougie or something.
No, mate, he's going to get the seat next to the toilet. So he's constantly bothered and has to deal with the smell as well. What do you say?
Yeah, we'll put the menu as curry. We'll put the whole menu as curry as well, so he can enjoy that.
Curry with added laxatives. Get it down, you lads. Lammy's by the toilet door. Totally deserved. RTRTMMA88 gave $10. Thank you so much. So thanks for sharing my Give, Send, Go, Mark and Steve, to help me get out of immigration detention in Australia. Passing the deed on. Thank you so much, mate. You didn't have to give that, and it's a pleasure to help you. And obviously, if you are watching and you get out of this and you want to do a stream, you know, if you want to do a stream to talk about your plight, you know, I'm more than happy to have people on to talk about their issues and their problems to get it out to a wider audience. Thank you. Fall of Turner gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, hail both of you from Denmark. Well, thank you so much. Iggs22 gave $5. Thank you very much. And said, Mark, Trump is in trouble with Israel. Netanyahu pushed hard for a ground operation in Iran, but Trump agreed to a 2-week ceasefire instead. No US boots on the ground. Israel feels the job is unfinished. Have we got a real rift brewing? this is what I'll say about Trump and Israel. Trump's relationship with Israel is really sort of a one-sided relationship. You know, you see these relationships where there's a guy who absolutely loves the girl and he's like, I'll do anything for you, you know, and he's texting her constantly and buying her gifts, and he's stood by his phone jittering, so every time she calls, he's answered that phone within one ring because he just doesn't want to miss it. That's kind of Trump with Netanyahu, because you have to remember, when Biden won the 2020 election, who was the first foreign leader to congratulate him? It was Netanyahu, Trump's best mate. And I think that Trump, somewhere deep down, must understand that the love affair is purely a one-way street. Because if Trump was in, let's say tomorrow, Trump was impeached and booted out, and, you know, Vance became president, what would happen? Well, Israel would love Vance and they wouldn't have any time for Trump. What if, you know, in 2028 at the presidential elections, Gavin Newsom comes in? Well, I can tell you, Israel will be the first to congratulate Gavin Newsom, regardless of what happens during the elections or how dirty things get, because that's how it is. They are totally mercenary. And they don't have friends. They have people they can use. And when they can no longer use them, they discard them. And that's going to be Trump's fate. And if Trump doesn't do exactly what Netanyahu says, he's going to have a hard time. And he may well see embarrassing things released that could compromise him. Because let's face it, he didn't attend all those Epstein parties and not do something that he doesn't want us all to see. And he's been very, very, very good at burying those files. And anyone that watched the Pam Bondi testimony could see just how much of a cover-up has really gone on. What do you think, Steve? You know, do you think there could be a rift between the two? And do you think America will ever put boots on the ground?
I can't ever see America and Israel sort of detaching themselves that too far. They're too intertwined, aren't they? So, to see them sort of go against each other, even if, like, in public they might have the odd spat and a disagreement, behind the scenes they're going to be absolutely fine. So I don't think that's ever going to happen. But in terms of boots on the ground, I don't know. It would be a stupid move from them, but Trump has been making some very rash decisions lately. He has been sort of being a little bit crazy. He was literally saying he was going to, like, wipe out an entire civilization as little as yesterday, I think it was, or the day before. So he's not really in a position where he might not do that. He might turn around one day and just go, oh, sod it, I'm invading. He wants a little island off the coast, doesn't he? So I don't know, to be honest with you. He's unpredictable at the moment.
He certainly is. And I did say this the other day. I said, I wouldn't be surprised waking up to see that Trump has nuked Iran. And I also wouldn't be surprised if I woke up and saw he'd done nothing at all and claimed there was a ceasefire and was pulling his troops out. Nothing surprises me, because he can do anything. He is that sort of demented and volatile. So that's a very good point. Blood and Honor gave a dollar. Thank you so much. And said, do you think we'll get another detailed ethnic group breakdown in future censuses? I think it's so damning we may have seen the last one. No, I think we will. I think we will see group breakdowns. And I think we will see them, because fundamentally, we're in a situation now where if they changed it, it would be too obvious. I think we will still see the broad group breakdowns, and we still see the broad group breakdowns in terms of births and, you know, school facts and statistics as well. So all of those things are very, very important. I think we'll have a good bead on what happens. But always remember, the census is best case scenario. But I don't think they're going to start covering up. And I don't think they need to. That's the sad thing. I don't think enough British people are awake yet to even understand the ramifications of what's going on. What do you think, Steve? Are they going to start covering things up, or will it just be business as usual because not enough people care?
I think it'd be that one, to be honest. I don't think enough of the public are fully aware of how bad the situation actually is. Unless you live in one of the major cities and you're not like into politics as much as we are, you're not going to look into the demographics as such. So you're not really going to notice how damaging it is. If you live in like a little village and you don't pay attention to politics, everything seems fine to you. So they're not going to really pay much attention. But I do think when the census comes out, we're going to, it's going to be an awful lot of depressed people, and there's going to be a lot of blackpilling, and people are going to go, oh no, it's over. And we're going to have a few weeks of everyone sort of being really doom posting. But it's, I think it'll probably go down to like 65% or something. 65% white British is probably what I would expect on the next breakdown. But it's still not the end of the world yet. We still have time left. It's not full time yet. So there is still a chance to reverse this, although every day that goes by makes it more difficult.
Well, look, they have released the latest ethnicity data for schools in England. So the total ethnic minority proportion of pupils in England is 38%, with primary schools being 38.4%, which is up from 37.4% the previous year. In secondary schools, the number of ethnic minority pupils is 37.8, up from 36.6 the previous year. So that is very telling, when almost 40% of all children in schools are from an ethnic minority background. I got to say, you know, that they are the future voters. That is a real issue. And turning it around is going to be so much more difficult, because you can see that the whitest part of the demographic pyramid is the old people. The most diverse part is the bottom. It's the young people. And the young people, they're the future of the country. That's one of the major problems. It's not just about immigration numbers. It's about the breeding patterns, the birth patterns within the UK. So keep that in mind. Hazelnut 3000 gave $10. Thank you so much, and said thank you both. Thank you very much. That is very much appreciated. Kalergi gave $2. Thank you so much, and said, you're fitter than any 20-year-old that took a clot shot, Mark. Well, thank you so much. I do my best, and I am still at the gym and still doing as much cardio as I can fit in. Pops and Me 22 gave $1. Thank you so much, and said, hi, Mark. I had an argument with a CivNat saying, listening to you, I'm being led down the wrong path. What are your thoughts? Definitely, definitely do not listen to me. No, if you listen to all the things I said tonight, I don't think I've offered anyone any bad advice. And specifically, you know, I've told young people, go out there, get a job, keep your head down, make sure you're in a position where you can support yourself, support a family, buy a house and be financially independent. I don't think you'd get any better advice than that. So yeah, anyone that says listening to me is a bad thing is wrong. Poit gave $50. Thank you so much, and said donation. That is very much appreciated, my friend. Thank you so much. It means a real lot to me that you are somebody who continuously donates so generously. It really helps, especially at the moment. Caribou gave $8. Thank you so much, and said, would Steve like to go on a nice 12-mile hike through a bog this summer?
No, I couldn't think of anything worse. I'm not a fan of hiking. A few people have asked me to go hiking recently. It's not my thing.
That's disappointing, mate, because I would have loved to have seen you at the PA camp. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like you're a happy camper. You're someone who's sort of against all that. But you know, maybe we'll get you at the conference again, because you are a great person to have there. And if the conferences are your thing, come to that. If the camps aren't, you know, obviously don't go to them. It's as simple as that. But it's always good to see you, and I do enjoy your company, mate. So if you ever change your mind, you're more than welcome. Scaredy Cat gave $8. Thank you so much, and said, hi, Stephen, Mark. A ceasefire between Iran and the worldwide Jewish community would result in merely Jews twisting Earth's 200 nations for more weapons to murder and smash society's structures. Once Iran is crushed, next will be Russia. So all of us must continue. Thank you so much. One of my concerns is, is Trump just going to want a ceasefire so he can restock the missiles and start raining down more hell? Is that where we're at? You know, are we going to see? Because he's done this in the past, hasn't he? Trump's gone there, cap in hand, to different nations and said, look, I'm here, you know, as a man of peace. And then 5 minutes later, bombs them. Could this all be another horrible bait and switch?
Well, this is the thing. No one knows, because he's being all so unpredictable at the moment. One day he's waking up and he's declaring victory. The next day he's complaining at Europe for not helping. And then he's saying that he's going to destroy civilization. Then he's saying there's a ceasefire. No idea. Maybe he's just restocking and they're going to go on another bombing campaign. But the longer this war goes on, the more damaging it is for the whole of his presidency. So I think that's probably playing at the back of his mind as well. So I don't know. Anything could change tomorrow. We could wake up tomorrow and there'd be a whole new story coming out. So anyone can guess, basically.
Yeah, well, that's a very good take. And I've said that his unpredictability is extremely dangerous. And unfortunately, we're in a situation now where, I hate to say this, but we've probably got the most mentally unstable, lunatic president with the best funded military and most technologically advanced military the world has ever seen. And that's got to be a recipe for disaster. But he's not using it for the good of the American people. Like, if, you know, I wouldn't agree with a war in the Middle East for any reason. But if Trump said, look, I'm going in these places to seize oil so that Americans can live a better life, okay, that would be wrong. But at least he'd be doing it for the American people. At least he'd be doing it for his own people to make their lives better. But all of this is for Israel, and he is making life worse, not just for Americans, not just for Iranians, but for everyone in the world, because we're all facing the blowback of this massive economic instability, which was completely unnecessary. So what he's doing is not only evil and wrong, but it doesn't benefit the people who voted for him. It doesn't benefit white Americans. You know, as I said, not that would make it any better, and I certainly wouldn't support a war, even if it benefited white Americans. If it's a war's unjust, it's unjust. But this is, you know, it adds insult to injury that the people who voted for him are getting the shaft the hardest. We've got 5 gifted subscriptions from Ethno Nationalist. Thank you so much, my friend. That is very generous. Remember, if you want, you can subscribe on Rumble. You know, if 400 or 500 people subscribed on Rumble at $5, they wouldn't notice that missing, but it would mean a great deal to me at the beginning of every month, because my bills would be paid for straight away and I wouldn't have to worry. Instead, I have to rely on Super Chats, which is always difficult, because if people are, you know, a bit low on reserves or don't feel like donating, no one's forced to, but it makes it a lot more difficult. So if people do get the free gifted subs, please consider continuing them and making sure you continue on with them. It means a great deal to me. So thank you for those who've donated generously and those who maintain subscriptions. Delta Troiska 125 gave $5. Thank you so much. I said, Steve, why are there so many illegal migrants in Great Yarmouth? My colleague went there the other day and mentioned how bad it was.
Well, they're everywhere now. This is the issue. It's not necessarily a targeted location thing with the illegals. It's, they had Operation Scatter, so it was pretty much spread them all over the country. But half of the people that your friend probably spotted were illegal immigrants, to be honest with you, mate. That's probably what they've seen. The illegals are few and far between, so unless they're lurking around outside hotels or in a park or something, you don't really see them spotting about. What you would have seen would just be loads of legal immigrants or loads that were born here.
Well, I think sometimes, mate, without being harsh, it's kind of hard to tell the difference. And when you do see the legals, I think one of the big problems is, and don't worry, mate, I'm not going to do a 20-minute rant and make you stay late. But one of the big problems I think we have as nationalists is we're constantly up against this sort of narrative of, well, are they legals or are they illegals? As if there's this huge defining barrier, as if a legal migrant, you know, as soon as they're legal, they're wearing a nice, smart suit, shirt and tie. They're walking through the street with a briefcase and a bowler hat on. off to work in a local British institution to make this country better. And then the illegals are mooching around, you know, in one of those leather jackets, dark blue jeans, Rockport shoes, not speaking the language, easily identifiable. But that's just not the case. You know, who do you think all these people are working in the Turkish barbers that can barely speak a word of English? Who do you think the Deliveroo drivers are virtually unintelligible, that every time you go into sort of a McDonald's, Burger King, KFC or any establishment that serves fast food, there's a queue of about five of them with the giant orange or blue bags stuffing bag after bag of food into them for white people who can't be asked to cook? Those are all legal migrants that we were told were only coming here if they qualified for this high level number of points under the Boris Johnson new rules. And we certainly weren't going to be bringing in endless bloody delivery drivers, barbers and low paid, immigrant workers who stood in takeaways. But that's exactly what we've got. And I think Steve's point, if he doesn't mind me saying, and I'm taking it a step further, is this big dividing line that the CivNats and that conservatives think exists between the legal and illegal migrants isn't actually there. And this idea that the legal migrants are these top level sort of, you know, Mr. Yakamoto, the award winning Japanese brain surgeon who's been flown in specially to save a little girl at Great Ormond Street Hospital, who's got a terrible, you know, blood clot in her brain. Well, the Mr. Yakamotos are either as rare as hen's teeth or don't actually exist. And the legal migrants that do exist are the endless number of, you know, Pakistani delivery drivers. That is the state of migration in Britain, unfortunately.
Well, this is the thing. That's a good point that you mentioned, actually, is the fact that most of these people would look at one of the immigrants that are illegal that came over as a Boris wave or was even born here. They'd look at them and go, oh, that's an illegal. And they would just go, yeah, we've got to deal with the illegals, and not even realize that the person that they're actually sitting there complaining about is actually a legal immigrant. They never really differentiate them. For instance, someone coming from Afghanistan on a legal route to someone coming from Afghanistan illegally in a dinghy, there's no difference to that person. They're still both going to act the same. It's exactly the same, especially if they've came from the same district in the country. They're going to be exactly the same. They don't magically change because one came in on a dinghy and the other one was flown in. It doesn't change anything.
Yeah, sort of, you know, Mohammed from, you know, North Village in Kandahar is not that different from Mohammed in South Village in Kandahar. The only difference is Mohammed from North Village came in through the legal resettlement route provided by the Conservatives, and Mohammed from South Village, he came in on a little dinghy. But if you stood them next to each other, you know, there is no difference. There is no difference. And, you know, which one of them turns out to be the guy that rapes the 14-year-old girl in the park? Well, it's a coin toss as to which one it is. That's the situation. And unfortunately, to take Steve's point to a slightly further degree, many of these legal migrants, legal, are actually people from places like Afghanistan, tens of thousands, that although they didn't come in on a dinghy, they came in through a very similar mechanism, which was the Conservative resettlement scheme. So rather than coming in on a dinghy and filling out the paperwork when they got here, they just filled out the paperwork before they got here. So that is, if you want to know the difference between an illegal Afghan migrant and a legal, it's difficult to say. So if you want to know the difference between an illegal Afghan migrant and a legal Afghan migrant, the difference is simply whether they filled out the paperwork in Afghanistan, then flew here at our expense, or they flew here or got a dinghy here at their expense and then filled out the paperwork when they were housed in a hotel at our expense. That's the difference. the country they filled out the paperwork in. I don't know if you've got anything to add to that, Steve, but...
I thought it's quite funny watching you try to explain that. But it's true though. That's literally what it is. If you fill out the paperwork in Afghanistan, then you're a legal immigrant. Come over on a dinghy or something and then fill it out in your hotel, then you're an illegal. And everyone gets outraged about the illegal fella and seems to think the legal fella's fine. But they're not. They're exactly the same. This is the issue. And it's not just that one country that we use an example. I expand that to every country in the world. These people are the same. They act the same. It doesn't matter whether they're coming from Africa or they're coming from the Middle East or whatever. They're all going to act the same as how they act in their own country, whether they come legally or illegally. And they don't magically, like you said, become like this high member of society because they've got a legal documentation. Most of, like, you got to remember, Axel Rudibekana, he was born here. He was the person who murdered those little girls in Southport. He was born here, and his parents were legal immigrants that came over legally, and they raised someone that actively went out and murdered three little girls. So, my point is, it's irrelevant on their legal status. An immigrant that shouldn't be here regardless.
Mate, I couldn't agree more. And you brought up the next point I was going to make. I know we're going to have to close it down, but people have a habit of sending super chats right at the end to extend the show. And obviously, I thank them just as much as I thank anyone throughout the show. So Commander of Agartha gave $10. Thank you so much. Said, hello, Mark. I just want to say that I got into politics really young, but I feel like all I know now is politics. I feel alienated and lost in life, sad and angry, knowing all this for years with little changes to show for it. How do I get into a positive mindset so I can be more active? Well, look, I'll say this, my friend. Firstly, if you are genuinely depressed and down in the dumps, email me, mark@thefallofwesternman.com. We can always talk. I can always help you. Secondly, get involved with Patriotic Alternative. We're a community-based group. We have community meetings. You can make friends. You can be part of our group, and we will help you. Thirdly, take positive steps in your life. As I say, people who get depressed, they often abuse substances. They often turn to things they shouldn't, and they become isolated by choice, because the more substances you abuse, the less you want to go out. Try to stay fit and healthy. Try to get out of the house. I've been through some really bad times in my life. I faced some horrible things, and I've had to go through a lot of it on my own. And I can tell you, I know this sounds stupid, but when you're in there, in your house, curtains closed, it's dark, the walls seem to be closing, and every time you look around that room, those walls seem to have narrowed slightly, and it gets more and more claustrophobic, and you don't want to step outside. You just turtle harder and harder. That's the worst thing you can do. The best thing you can do if you're feeling down in the dumps is shake it off, have a shower, get out there, go for a walk, or get up, put your jogging shoes on, go for a run, get some fresh air, touch grass, realize there's a whole world out there. It's not in a state of sort of hellish collapse. It's still ticking along at the moment, just about, and you have a place in that world. And if we can help you, we will. If I can personally help you, I will. And I want to make this point again. I am absolutely thankful for every super chat that's come in tonight. But if you reach out to me and need help, it isn't a paid service. I don't charge anyone for help. I'm not like Tommy Robinson, who it's like £100 for a 3-minute video, or other people who charge, you know, thousands of dollars for a 15-minute call or to be in a Discord group. There's no Discord group with a, you know, $1,000 buy-in. I'm pretty much available to anyone who needs me. And I get regular emails, and I am willing to do voice chats or sort of video calls with people who need help or who have problems. And I will help you if I can. So don't feel like you're alone, mate. Sir Trancelot gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, hey, Steve, it was good to shake your hand at Nuneaton. Look forward to the next time you are up in the area again. Keep up the good work, guys. Well, thank you so much, Sir Trancelot. Steve, you can answer that final super chat, and we have no more. So you are good to give us your final thoughts of the show.
Yeah, well, thanks for the kind words, mate. It's good for coming to the protest. as for everyone listening, I would say when we make our announcement for our next events, more people that come, the better, because obviously we want this to continue to grow. We don't want it to just be a flash in the pan where we've had a few protests and not really achieved anything. We want to get to the point where we've got thousands of us all standing together, because then we have a real block, and then we'll actually have some sort of influence onto the political landscape. At the moment, it's all of the SIBNATs running wild, controlling all of the street movement, which makes that think that that's the position that everyone in the country holds, because that's what's seen on the media, that's what's seen by everyone on social media. And then all of the people that see this think, oh, well, I'll go and stand with those events, and that they continue to grow. We need to change that dynamic and get people to stand with us. So the more that come with us, the better.
I couldn't have agreed more. We appreciate all the support that everyone gives us, but if you can come and stand with us, and if we can get a few hundred extra people and we can build this street movement and get our message directly to the public, it's so important. Because when the public come and meet us, they like us, they see we're normal people, it's important. And please do support Steve as well. He's a really good guy. He's always there. And look, if I need something and I need to chat to somebody, Steve's always been there. He's been a good friend. I appreciate his work. I like what he does. And he's helped bring this nationalist unity into reality. So thanks, Steve, for everything you do. Ulrich von Hutten gave $10 and said, love from Germany. Well, thank you so much, my friend. And look, it's been a really good show tonight. At peak, we had over 600 people viewing across all channels. So thank you so much. And Steve's been a great guest. I just want to say thank you to everyone. Thank you to everyone who donated. And remember, if you're watching this on replay, you can donate through Entropy, Crypto, or become a Rumble subscriber at any time. If you're one of those people who watches on replay, please do donate if you can. You know, times are difficult at the moment, but I do appreciate everything that people send. And as I say, when we have shows that are viewed by 10, 20,000 people, if everyone just gave sort of, you know, $1, $2, $3, we'd have a huge wealth, but we wouldn't, you know, be calling on individuals to make these big super donations, which we also obviously do appreciate. But please do chip in if you can. So thank you to Steve. Thank you to all the donors. Thank you to everyone who tuned in tonight. It's been a great show. I really appreciate it. I love you all. And we'll see you same time next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you all. Love you and good night.